Welcome once again to Word on the Hills with me, Felicity Sidnell-Reed, and my co-host, Gwyn Sheltimer. This week, we are celebrating our fifth birthday and looking forward to another year of working on this series. When we started out as neophytes, we made plans for making a series of 12 episodes. And here we are, with over 400 shows under our belts. Our first show focused on us and the Spirit of the Hills Writers Group. I described the group and our goals. We have 32 members in our group, which includes novelists, short story writers, poets, playwrights, as well as writers of biographies, memoirs, travel books, and journalists who write articles in other areas. We also have several editors and publishers among our number. When we heard about Small Town Radio with its interest in local people, talents, and events, we thought the diversity of our group could provide some interesting encounters for listeners. Our first interviewees and readers are all members of Spirit of the Hills, but we hope to extend participation to other writers from our region in the future. Well, now we have 52 members in our group, and they are as diverse as ever and come from a wider area. Some new members live as far away as Toronto, Belleville, Peterborough, and our guests on this show come from even further away, from Kingston to Hamilton. So, Gwyn, who did we interview first? Tell us about some of our first interviewees.
Well, originally, as you say, we were only planning on having 12 programs.
Right.
And I looked up the list, and it was interesting to see that of the 12, most of them are still a member of the group.
Mm-hmm.
And I picked four that I thought would be fun to do a kind of then and now catch-up on them. So today, we're going to feature Peggy Diamond Levy, Shane Joseph, Linda Hutzel Manning, and Eric Wright. All these authors have done new books and other interesting things in the years since we first started. And so first of all, I think we'll start with Peggy. When we first interviewed Peggy, Peggy was already the author of 9 novels. Now, Peggy writes for children and young people, usually Canadian history, and she publishes through Dundurn Press. And Dundurn Press had asked her to do a series of women in Canadian history. And at that time, she had already finished her book on Mary Pickford, which I believe was called Canada's Sweetheart. And she told us about that in the very first program. Okay, the second in that series was on Laura Secord, and that became a finalist for the Ontario Legislature's Speaker's Award in 2012, which is quite an honor. And then she went on to do a third one on Molly Brandt, and we did a program on the Molly Brandt book with her more recently. They're all still very popular. In fact, one of her first books, which wasn't in that series, it was called The Movie Years, is about to be republished. And Peggy herself is featured in a new documentary by Doug Knutson about Hollywood North in Trenton. So that's kind of exciting for Peggy. So we chose a reading actually from the Mary Pickford book that Peggy did, just in honor of the movie years, because obviously the two go hand in hand. So here's Peggy reading from her Mary Pickford book, Canada's Sweetheart.
I thought I would like to read a little bit from Mary Pickford, Canada's Silent Siren, America's Sweetheart. I'm actually reading from the prologue to the book. One morning, late in the year 1899, Charlotte Smith answered a knock at the front door of her Toronto home. Charlotte was a pretty woman in her mid-20s, just 5 feet tall, with lustrous blue-black hair and a pleasantly rounded figure. The stranger on the doorstep removed his hat. "I'm here about the room," he said. Charlotte's 3 young children pressed around her, filling the doorway, eager to see who the caller might be. The little one, 3-year-old Jack, or Johnny as he was known when he was on his best behavior, and Lottie, who was 5, had escaped the clutches of their older sister Gladys. Charlotte promptly lifted Johnny into Gladys' arms and shooed them all back inside. "The sign in your window, madam? You have a room for rent?" "Oh, I don't rent rooms to gentlemen, sir," Charlotte said. "I'm a widow, you see. Except for little Johnny there, this is a household of women. I only ever take ladies as lodgers." "But I'm a married man," the stranger hastened to explain. "My wife will be with me in the city wherever I stay. May I bring her around to meet you? You'll like her. I'm sure you will." The man introduced himself as Mr. Murphy, and seeing that the young landlady seemed likely to reconsider his request, he suggested that he come back later for her answer. Charlotte agreed and shut the door. Now there would be time to discuss the proposal with her invalid mother, Catherine Hennessy, who lived with her, and to confer with her sister, Lizzie Watson, who lived next door. In the end, the family agreed that renting the master bedroom under these circumstances was quite acceptable, and they voted in favor of the well-dressed gentleman. It was impossible to know then, but by renting out the room to Mr. Murphy and his wife, Charlotte was setting in motion a series of events that would change the lives of the Smith family forever. 7-year-old Gladys Smith, so often in charge of her two young siblings, had been born in a house on Toronto's University Avenue on April the 8th, 1892, the same year that the first electric streetcar went into service in that city, and Queen's Park became the home of the provincial legislature. 211 University Avenue was a tiny two-story brick row house with only 6 rooms. There were no houses on the other side of the street, and out front, the bridal path was shaded by flowering chestnuts and red maple trees. Gladys later had pleasant memories of sailing like the wind down that path on her bicycle, and such was her attachment to her first home that when the house was torn down in 1943, she had 20 of its bricks sent to her in California. But that was many years later, long after young Gladys Louise Smith had been dubbed America's Sweetheart and her name changed to Mary Pickford. She was known then as the highest paid woman in the world and today as the most powerful woman in the history of motion pictures.
Thank you, Peggy. Our second guest that we've chosen to feature today was Shane Joseph, author of several novels at the time, a collection of short stories, and a partner in Blue Denim Press, which he had recently set up with his wife and operates out of Coburg. He spoke about being an immigrant writer and his novel, The Ulysses Man. Since then, he's written many more novels, and recently a short story collection called Crossing Limbo was published with Morning Rain Publishing. And, of course, he's also very recently been the publisher of the third anthology by Hill Spirits Writers, Hill Spirits 3. He has a new collection of short stories in the works. So we're going to have Shane read for you a reading from his latest work, Crossing Limbo.
I'm going to read the opening section of a story called The Second Chance. And it's about an older man who's taking a cruise to relive his honeymoon cruise that he took 40 years ago with his now dead wife. And he's looking to see whether he can find that magic that sparked off 40 years ago. So it's called The Second Chance. Rocco lurches down the corridor, holding the handrail as the ship groans and sways left, then right. Tonight is rough, rougher than most on the Mediterranean. He has walked this corridor many times on the voyage, unable to sleep, plagued by the time zone shift and by ghosts from the past that assail him when he allows his mind to rest. The digital clock in his stateroom flashes the moment he begins dropping off to sleep, jolting him awake. He has wondered if his insomnia is partly due to the results of his last medical test, a test that has prompted this voyage. A young woman in a short, glittery dress careens towards him, swaying from more than the ship's motion. Glazed eyes stare through mascara-plastered eyelashes. She whispers a muffled "scusi," bumps him and passes, leaving him in a wake of perfume, perspiration, and alcohol. The sound of the disco thumps through a doorway. "Ah, to be young and unthinking again," mutters Rocco, as he turns and gazes after the woman who has found her cabin and is fumbling with the pass key. She drops the key and swears, and as she bends to pick it up, the ship lurches, sending her sprawling on all fours across the narrow passageway. He goes to her rescue. He has always done this, rescued damsels in distress, often to his detriment. They were most vicious when he held elevator doors open for them, a practice he has since given up. He reaches the woman and extends a hand. She accepts it gratefully and pulls herself up. She's strong, and he almost falls on top of her, but his grip on the handrail holds. He pushes the fallen key towards her with his patent leather shoe, and she, still holding onto his hand, reaches down and picks it up. She slides it into the lock upside down and starts cranking the door handle violently. "Un momento," he says, reverses the key in the slot, and the door swings open just as the ship tilts sharply to starboard, dragging them both into her cabin. The vessel rights itself, slamming the cabin door shut behind him. He's inside an unfamiliar cabin with a drunk Italian woman. Surely she must be traveling with a young man closer to her age who will barge in at any moment and kick him out. He tries to retrace his steps and leave, but she is still holding onto him with one hand. The rest of her has fallen across the bed. A single bed.
Thank you, Shane.
And there you have an update on two of the very first interviewees for the program, and we'll tell you about another two after this short break.